And I still believe that these problems can be solved.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death!
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
This is The Political Show.
Hey, 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 and welcome to The Political Show right here on XFM, where radio has never been better. I'm your girl, Cynthia, but you know you can call me Gix, and with me in studio we have...
Gavin Enslin.
Pastor Gavin Enslin, right here on The Political Show, where Christ Politics is...
Hot Politics.
Hot Politics. And this week's Hot Politics, we are continuing with part two of part two. Yes.
Yeah.
Part two of part two.
Yes.
Of how dictators take control... The first part we looked at, we did a comparison on the tactics that Nazi Germany used, and we compared that with the tactics that Steenhuisen uses with the DA. And last week we started looking at the Bolsheviks and how their tactics are similar to the ANC.
Well, no. The ANC modeled themselves.
Yes.
On the Bolsheviks. And obviously the tactics there come from the likes of Karl Marx.
Yeah.
And Vladimir Lenin.
Yeah.
And perfected by Stalin.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph Stalin. Yeah. So the ANC modeled themselves after the Soviet Union. In fact, the ANC started out as a Christian organization. And the leaders of the ANC then went to the Soviet Union. And somewhere in the 1950s, they were co-opted. And they, they took on the Marxist-Leninist ideology, and they embraced the Marxist-Leninist tactics in order to gain power and then entrench power once they've won the election.
Yes. So we went through a couple of strategies, such as capturing knots of power, mastering the narrative, turning crisis into opportunities, undermining rivals, blurring party and state, and we also looked at using fear and coercion. And this week we're going to look at the final few tactics that they used, and we're going to go into depth with it. Pastor Gav, do you want to give a more brief explanation?
Yeah, so obviously the Bolsheviks took power in October 1917 in the old Russia, and within a few years it became the Soviet Union, which was... The abbreviation for it was USSR, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. And so it wasn't just Russia. There were a number of other nations that were incorporated into this nation called the Soviet Union. And it was a communistic nation. And the way that Vladimir Lenin took power was exploiting the weaknesses of the ruling Tsar. And, those in power and then creating unrest. In effect, making the country ungovernable. That was the aim, because out of the chaos you can bring about a communist government.
Mm.
And the ANC used exactly the same tactics. They were trained, as I said, in the Soviet Union. They also had a lot of training from the Viet Cong, from the Vietnamese War. And the Viet Cong weren't just fighting the Americans. The Viet Cong were fighting other Vietnamese liberation movements. And a lot of the killings that happened there were by the Viet Cong on their own people, so that they could grab the mantle and become the liberation party of the Vietnam. And in actual fact, the ANC was trained in how to do that, and they used those tactics, especially in the years leading up to 1994, and they attacked a lot of the opposition. And then of course they got into power, and when they got into power, we spoke last week about the whole thing of blurring party and state.
Mm.
So you weren't sure, is this ANC, is it the state? Whoever the ANC chooses as president is going to become the president of the nation. They would actually say things like every time the ANC had a conference, that basically now they're going to in effect be voting for the new president of the country, because it was just assumed that the ANC was going to win. And, so fear and coercion is one of the big tactics that are used, in order for the Marxists to gain power. We saw that in South Africa, and, we're going to talk more about that today.
Yes, that it's going to be an interesting show. I mean, if you've been listening to our other shows, they've been really, really interesting. And we are going to continue with that right here on The Political Show, where Christ Politics is.
Hot Politics.
Hot Politics.
We help distributors grow their sales by over 15% in the first 90 days with our automated mobile software solution. RapidTrade is used by over 16,000 users worldwide, and we process over 120,000 transactions per day on both iOS and Android. From net ordering and management to e-commerce and even van sales, or electronic proof of delivery, we've got your business covered. Call us for a demo on 011-493-9755 or email us at sales@rapidtrade.com. Go on. Make your customer a happy one today by getting onto RapidTrade.
So continuing with the Bolsheviks and the ANC, at number seven, we are looking at patronage as a weapon. Lenin's Bolshevik party ballooned from 20,000 members to over a million by rewarding loyalty with positions and resources. And when we look at that with the ANC, this is mirrored through state contracts, jobs in state-owned enterprises, and government posts. Patronage is both carrot and stick, and it builds loyalty and disciplines dissent. This is where BEE and triple BEE come to play. So on paper, they're about correcting the injustices of apartheid through economic redistribution. I mean, that's what everyone believes BEE to be. Well, most people believe BEE to be. But in practice, the companies that have actually now looked at it and have tried to apply it and things like that, they function much like the Bolshevik land and factory seizures. The rhetoric is empowerment for the people, but the reality often funnels with wealth and contracts to a politically connected few. And access to economic opportunities becomes tied to party structures, creating a new elite whose prosperity depends on the ANC's survival. Just as the Bolsheviks built loyalty by redistributing lands and factories to insiders, the ANC builds loyalty through empowerment deals, tenders, and state contracts, keeping both business and politics firmly under its orbit.
Yeah, so the ANC obviously came to power, and I mean, I remember one of the things that was the discussion point of the day where they would talk about there needs to be a redistribution of wealth. So you need to redistribute the wealth from the whites to the masses. So that has been the policy since the ANC came into power in 1994. They haven't fully achieved it, but the reality at the end of the day is there wasn't enough wealth in South Africa amongst the white people to distribute amongst the black people who were then and are now the majority population. You needed to generate new wealth. Mm. And there are plenty of minerals and plenty of other natural resources within South Africa. There are plenty of talents amongst the people of South Africa to be able to actually increase the wealth of the nation. And thereby, by implication, you're going to increase the wealth of individual people and individual families. Mm. And the thing is, at the end of the day, Looking at all of this, you know, in order to redistribute the wealth, you've got to take it from the one in order to give it out to the other. Mm. So what the ANC has done is they've taken a lot from, they haven't taken everything. Stalin took everything. Mm. But the ANC hasn't taken everything, but they've taken a lot and it hasn't gone out. Mm. It's gone to a few. So what that means now is in South Africa, you're in a situation whereby the economy is struggling due to the fact that you cannot get anywhere without having a connection in government. Mm. The other thing that also happened as a result of this, if some people come along and they start up a small business, somewhere along the line, if they become a threat to the big boys have access to power. Mm. And so when they have access to power, they therefore have the access to shut you down one way or another or to just buy you out. Mm. And therefore, the South African economy, forgetting even the state now, is extremely centralized in the hands of a few people. Mm. And trillions and trillions of rands. I remember the one Professor William Gumede said, trillions and trillions of rands have benefited less than 100 people in South Africa. Mm. So that is the scenario. And they've used the whole black economic empowerment thing to actually get companies and all of these things out of the hands of the whites, and you're supposed to give it over to the blacks. They're not even doing that. Mm-hmm. So many times they expropriate land from the white farmer, or they expropriate a house from the white person or whatever, but the ownership doesn't pass to any black person on the ground. The ownership stays with the state. And there's been many abuses with state officials taking even what they call the RDP houses, you know, Reconstruction Development Plan houses, and all sorts of things. They've been taken by the chosen few. And basically, just like with the Communist Party in the Soviet Union, what you have now is you have to have connections within the ANC, or you're not going to get anything. So it limits economic opportunities. The other thing is that now, for the first time, the courts are starting to find against BEE.
Mm-hmm.
There's one or two court cases that are being lost. But I think BEE, I'm going to be honest with you now, BEE was a forerunner. They want total control of the economy. So how do you get that? Well, you can get that by controlling carbon.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the whole climate change agenda comes from. Because every person, as they breathe out carbon dioxide. So if you start controlling carbon, you can start controlling every facet of life. For example, they'll tell you can't eat beef due to the fact that cows emit a lot of methane gas, which is a greenhouse gas. All right, literally. So they're telling you must become a vegan, and that if you become a vegan, you're going to let off less flatulence. What I'm finding out is if you only eat beef, you're gonna exhibit less flatulence than if you eat all of the starches and things that that the vegans will eat. But in very much the same way that they count points to give someone a BEE rating and give them a level, what's coming now and is going to start, I believe, in early 2026, is that you're going to have a climate rating too.
Mm. Yeah.
So that, you know, if you can control carbon, you can control everything.
Yeah. And moving on to that, the whole thing about control and stuff like that, obviously, we live in a democracy. Yes. Just let's pause and think about that. The eighth tactic is democracy in name, centralism in practice. So the Bolsheviks came to power in 1917 under the electrifying slogan, "All power to the Soviets," a promise that ordinary workers' councils would directly govern the new socialist state. On paper, it sounded like radical grassroots democracy, but in reality, power quickly concentrated into the hands of Lenin and the Central Party leadership. The Soviets became little more than rubber stamps, while real decisions flowed through the Politburo and ultimately to Lenin himself.
The Politburo.
Politburo.
It was a Russian term.
Okay.
So that's like the main council type.
Okay.
Know,
yeah.
For if you describe it as the main council.
Mm. Yeah, and then when we see with the ANC, the African National Congress, it mirrors this trajectory in a striking way. Since 1994, South Africa has been a parliamentary democracy, while with a progressive constitution and regular elections. Yet in practice, key decisions are often made at Lithuli House, the ANC's headquarters, rather than in parliament or through an open democratic debate. Cabinet appointments, policy directions, even parliamentary votes often follow party instructions rather than independent legislative deliberation. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that is very much true.
Yeah.
And, you know, the ANC came out with a policy of being centralized.
Mm.
And if everything's centralized, then your central authorities become a bottleneck. And people can't get anywhere without the centralization. And I mean, the socialist dream is to regulate everything. Mm. And even when you listen to the news media talks and promotes a narrative that says the more regulation that a parliament passes, the better the parliament is.
Mm.
The more regulation a parliament passes, the more hardworking the members of parliament are. And the reality at the end of the day is, now in South Africa now, we need 100,000 times less regulation than what we've got right now. There's far too much legislation. And therefore what happens is, the smaller businesses and the poor who are trying to start a business, they get hamstrung by the fact that you've got all of this mountain of regulation and administration that you've got to overcome. And of course, the big companies, they do it easy. They just employ a department in order to do it. But when you're a small business, you can't afford that.
Mm.
And so you get drowned down in paperwork.
Mm.
And this is a mechanism that is used for control. Right now, they're even trying to control the church in South Africa through a commission called the CRL, which is the Cultural and Religious Rights body. And it's supposed to be a body that protects religious rights. But instead, what's happening is that they want to now take the church.
Mm. Yeah. So the question is, can we truly say, like in South Africa, that we live in a democracy?
You define democracy.
So if we had to look at democracy, so on paper, democracy means that you have a progressive constitution that guarantees human rights and the separation of powers, a regular, free and fair election overseen by an independent electoral commission, a constitutional court with real power to striking down unconstitutional laws or executive overreach, and a vibrant civil society and a free press that routinely exposes corruptions and hold leaders accountable. All right, so on paper, we tick those boxes. But now if we have to look deeper, we see party state dominance. The ANC's long-standing dominance has bled. Well, it's not really long-standing anymore, but they still kind of...
it's still long-standing.
Obviously, we as the, South Africans are tired, in a sense. But we spoke about this where it's like the better the devil you know type of thing. I think we spoke, if it was not last week, the week before. No, it was last week. So party... The ANC's long-standing dominance has blurred the lines between party and state, so key decisions often happen at Lutuli House, the ANC headquarters, rather than in parliament or through open public debates. Then we also see democracy without accountability. South Africans vote regularly, but do they really have real accountability mechanisms when leaders fail?
No, they don't.
We don't. And then... What's this? Elections versus everyday democracy, something else that you have to look at. So even though the elections happen every five years, but democracy is supposed to be continuous citizen participation through active local governance, responsive institutions, and accountable leadership, yet... we see service delivery protests across the country. Local councils often fail basic government standards, and public participation in policy making doesn't really exist. And then the fourth one is freedom without power. South Africans enjoy freedom of speech, media, and association, hallmarks of democracy, but many feel powerless to influence the system beyond voting. So what are your, based on those four things, basically it says here that we live by law and structure in a democracy, but in practice it doesn't really resemble what a democracy is.
There was a statement that you made at the end there that, people feel powerless except with a vote.
Yeah.
I want to correct that statement. People are powerless except for the vote. The only way that you have any sort of power is if you pitch onto the street with 1 million or 2 million other people.
Yeah.
Then that'll shake the politicians to the boots because they'll be thinking about the next time there's an election. And other than that, you have no recourse. And even then, you're relying on the fact that that politician wants to be re-elected. Because if they don't want to be re-elected, they don't even have to care about what you might be doing with your protest. The other thing is that any law that's passed by parliament, there's supposed to be a public participation process. So that the people are supposed to be able to give their comments. But there's no statute in place for that. So people can come and 1 million people can say, we don't want this law. And they can say, we've taken this into account and we're passing it anyway. So there is really no participation from people in terms of the life of making law and controlling, you know, the aspects of society that need to be controlled and all sorts of things like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you want to get somewhere with the government, you've got to, at this stage, even now, even with this GNU, you know, even now, the reality is if you want to get somewhere, you need to know someone in the ANC. Yeah. Otherwise, you're going to get stuck.
Yeah. where we look at both the Bolsheviks and the ANC, it's a reminder that political liberation does not guarantee lasting freedom and accountability. When we look at 1994 and the ANC came into power and stuff, it was New South Africa. There was the term born, what's this, being those that were born after 1994 in 1994, they were known as the Born Frees. I remember following a documentary called Born Free, looking at the lives of the people that were born, certain people that were born in 1994 and things like that. But now if we have to fast forward years later, we can't really say that that South Africa that they were speaking about is the South Africa that we're living in today. So without strong institution, independent checks on power and genuine economic inclusion, liberation movements can transform into dominant party states where the form of democracy survives, but the substance slowly erodes. What are your final thoughts on our comparison with the Bolsheviks and the ANC?
It's two thoughts. Obviously, the first thing is the whole premise of the democratic leadership structures that came out in particular through Great Britain and the United States is the fact that people are sinners. Mm. Therefore, you cannot give any individual human being absolute power. And so the concept then within Western democracies was that you have multiple centers of power. So, for example, you've got the legislature, which is like in South Africa, it's a parliament. In the US, it's Congress. In Great Britain, it's parliament, you know, and et cetera, et cetera. But then you've got a second branch of government, which is administrative state. That's like the presidency or the prime minister with the cabinet ministers. And each cabinet minister is managing a different section of the country. And, you know, they actually execute the power of the law. The legislatures make the law. They write the law, and they also act as oversight for the guys that have the power, that have the police and all of that. And then there's a third branch, which is called the judiciary. And the judiciary is there to interpret the law and to pass judgments in a court case based on whatever the law says. So that model comes up because you can't trust any individual human being.
Mm.
All right, so that needs to be in place if you want to really prosper as a democracy. But the second thing I want to tell you, democracy only works with the moral people. The moral fiber of South Africa has been destroyed. The communists are in large part to blame for that, along with the old apartheid government, which forced the migrant labor system, where the black people had to be in their own homeland somewhere, and the man would come to the city to work.
Yeah.
And then there'd be another wife in the city, and it really messed up the family structure of black South Africans.
Yeah.
And so those two factors alone, will bring down a nation.
Yeah.
And the reality is, if you don't have a moral people, then all of these democratic ideals won't happen.
In Psalm 82, verse 3 to 4, it says, "Defend the weak and the fatherless, uphold the cause of the poor and the oppressed. Rescue the weak and the needy. Deliver them from the hands of the wicked."
Now, that is the role and the responsibility of, number one, every single person in a church, every single leader in a church, and every politician that goes into a nation's parliament or a province's legislature or a city council of a city has that responsibility. And if they follow those words, they will look after those that are the most vulnerable in society, and they will look after them as a labor of love. They will look after them expecting nothing in return. But what happened is we have cold-hearted people that are running the show due to the fact that their lives are broken and messed up.
Yeah.
And they don't have the softness, the heart of flesh, to be able to give, you know, to the people of the nation. And so if a nation wants to be a true democracy and measure up to the democratic ideals that many had many centuries ago, then the reality is there's got to be a revival of Christian faith. Because that's the only time that people become, righteous when they get into rulership positions, is if they've got the Lord Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior.
Amen. Amen. This has been an amazing show. Let us know your thoughts on our social media platforms or in the comments down below. I'm your girl Cynthia, but you know you can call me Gix. And with me in studio, we've had
Gavin Enslin.
Pastor Gavin Enslin, right here on The Political Show on Active FM, where radio has never been better. And Christ Politics is
Hot Politics.
Hot Politics.
Active FM. Radio has never been better.